This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Welcome to The 10th Voice. This is your host, Elizabeth Anderson, and this is the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club, which is the every second Saturday of The 10th Voice. We have an exciting panel today. We have author Anne McMahon. We're talking about her book, Backcast. We have author Bev Prescott joining us by phone from Maine. Michelle Pond is here, local poet. And then we also have Jeff Vincent, an avid reader. So first we are going to have Michelle Pond read a poem that I heard in June at the Celebration of Queerness event at the Writer's Place, and I thought, what a perfect poem to introduce the show. So Michelle, would you read?
Thank you, Elizabeth. My romance with lesbian literature. Lindsay Gordon was my first. A Scottish journalist, she always got the story and the bad guys. Lindsay also got numerous sprains, strains, breaks, and contusions. Good thing she fell in love with a doctor. I left Lindsay for Kate Delafield. It was Lindsay's fault. She left the latest Catherine V. Forrest mystery on the nightstand. Did she not think I would be curious? Besides, Val McDermid had stopped adding to the Gordon series. I met up with Kate in the library. She served in the Marine Corps and was sent to Vietnam. She then became an LAPD detective. There was a bonus with these novels, the lists. In the back of each book, there was a list of other lesbian literature, more authors, more characters, multiple genres. I was no longer monogamous. I found Radcliffe Sheriff Rhys Conlon in Provincetown. She also was a Marine. Is there a pattern here? J.M. Redmond's Mickey Knight lived in New Orleans, and Jerry Hill's Tori Hunter in Dallas. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul, there was Jane Lawless. Jane could really cook. No, really, she was a chef and restaurateur. She started out as an amateur sleuth, but eventually got a PI's license. Jane and I have never been exclusive, but we've had at least a dozen rendezvous, and I'm looking forward to another one soon. Thank goodness Ellen Hart keeps writing. After years of author hopping, I settled down with my favorites. I even was reunited with Lindsay and Kate when McDermid and Forrest each added another adventure to her series. I became a creature of habit. I was perfectly happy with my select few until I received a nudge from Sandra Moran to go further back into the history of lesbian literature and wider into the LGBTQ of the community. I started with a taste of salt and now relish a helping of alphabet soup every month.
Thank you, Michelle. I think that's the perfect way to kick off a book club show, especially one on lesbian fiction. And I wanted to introduce the panelists while we get Anne and Bev on the air. First, I've always been a reader. I have 2 degrees in literature and had founded and run lesbian book clubs for about a dozen years. And I had gone away from lesbian literature for about 4, and Sandra Moran brought me back, as you described in your poem. And one of our panelists today is Jeff Vincent, and I happen to know, many of you know that I was in a gay men's book club for about a year, and Ronnie was on the poetry panel. His husband Jeff joins us today, and I happen to know that Jeff is an avid reader. So would you tell a little about your background in reading books?
Wow, my background in reading, that's a long story, I guess. Certainly have been reading my entire life. I have my mother to thank for that. She was never a very good reader as a child, and so she wanted to make sure her children did not have that same issue, so she pushed us into literature right away, and now she's also a big reader, too. But certainly I think I have always been reading a book. I've had one going every time. Every night, got another book to work on.
Wonderful. And Michelle, I know that reading is very important to you and also writing. So would you tell a little bit about your adventures in reading and also how you became a poet?
Sure, Elizabeth. Similarly, I think my parents always encouraged us to read. And so at that time, I was a regular going to the library. And whenever I became interested in a subject, I would go to the library and find books about it to learn more about it, because obviously this was pre-internet, internet days. And I really wanted to become a writer from a pretty young age, actually a journalist. And so I did go to journalism school, but I took a little bit different turn. I wanted to be a sports writer, but I ended up kind of working in sports public relations rather than for a newspaper. And I came to poetry late, but it's certainly become a wonderful and important part of my life.
Thank you. And let's see if we have our two authors on the phone. Bev, are you there?
I am.
Wonderful.
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm fine. And let's see if we have Ann McMahon.
I'm here. I just got out of hair and makeup.
Wonderful. Did you see, I posted on my page that we have installed a disco ball for the first time in the studio for you?
I noticed that right away. It's probably a mistake, though, because, you know, I tend to be distracted by shiny objects.
Well, that was my hope. Well, Bev, let me start with you. We were just telling a little about ourselves and how we got into reading and, in your case, writing. Would you tell a little about your background?
Sure. So I've always been a really adventurous person, and as a little kid, reading was a way to go and explore places that I otherwise couldn't explore. So I'd say that's really where I really started to learn to appreciate reading. Also, my father, who's a really incredibly smart person, never learned to read. So reading always kind of held a mystery to me that I was really attracted to, and I think that's also what sparked my interest in writing. I think being able to tell a story in words is a way to say something about the world and about things we care about.
And Anne, would you please tell a little about how you became an author and what reading means to you?
Well, you know, I'm actually sitting here listening, have been really moved by the things the other folks on the panel had said about their childhoods and the interest that their parents had, you know, either in making them curious about their environments or for some of us being taken to the library. For me, one of my best and most profound memories of childhood were I was the last of four children and the only one out of the four who ever had any kind of focused time alone with our mother, just by virtue of being born last. And my fondest memories are of the times she would take me to the public library in the afternoons, which was really a break for her, but a thrill for me. And I just fell in love with books, everything about them, you know, not just what they convey, but what they are, you know, how they smell, what it's like to hold them, all of that. So reading has particularly been a passion of my life. And it was really by accident that I finally, at an advanced age, decided to take a chance and tell a story of my own. So when I jokingly refer to myself as an accidental author, I'm not really kidding.
Well, thank you for that. And I want to start out our discussion today reading a review that I saw on Amazon by Lee Lynch, who, of course, is very well known in the field of lesbian literature. She's one of the first authors that I read when I came out, as you said, at an advanced age. And she said about Backcast, that it is an ambitious and challenging novel. It encompasses an array of worlds, the arts, lesbians, writers, feminism, sport fishing, romance, magical realism, and humor, all intricately bound up with the depth of human experience. There is a universality to the story that will appeal to any reader. And then she talks about there being plenty of action. It's a tale of hurting cats, or lesbians in this case. No one surpasses the author's wit. And I'll stop there. You are very witty, and you've carried that wit into this novel. What was it like to write this novel? Was it a pleasure? Was it a chore? Was it both?
Well, this, you know, how we're always, I mean, I guess, you know, every author, everyone who aspires to write is frequently reminded to write what you know. And this book is probably my best and closest attempt at doing that. And I use humor. I've done that, you know, historically growing up and through my adult life as a way to deal with things that are much harder edged and serious. So I think as an author, I use humor and drama almost the way a boxer trades punches. You know, where you sort of jab and is the word feint? I think that's right.
Yes.
You dance forward and then back up, you know. So writing the book was difficult, challenging, and also fun in the more humorous parts that I presented almost as much as comic relief for the reader as for me as the author, because so much of it was... So many of the stories were really difficult to tell. I don't know if that really answers your question.
It did. And you mentioned...
Oh, good.
You mentioned so many characters, and I think that was, as a reader, and I want to throw this out to the panelists, this was a challenge. Did anyone have any trouble keeping up with the characters initially?
I certainly appreciated that they were all introduced. I felt like, I call it kind of Ocean's 11 style of just, here's all the characters, here's who they're going to be, almost like a cast of characters at the beginning of a play. I definitely marked that page and had to go back to it a couple of times. You also referred to the characters by their first and last name quite a bit, which actually was really helpful. So I didn't have too much trouble in the end. It was, and I don't know if we want to get into the essays just yet, but the way you used the characters in the essays was really unique.
And Bev, what about you? Did you need to go back to that, we'll call it the character glossary.
Yeah, so this is a book for me that was very, it had a lot of intricate detail, and so to really appreciate what was going on, one had to be fully engaged in a book. And so I there were times when I had to go back and refer to who the characters were. But I think that was an important part of the book because it was meant to be, and I'm quoting from something that Barb says in the beginning, actually towards the end, where she's talking about how the sculptures, this lattice work of stylized webs, and so the book is like that. It's not necessarily this linear book that is typical of a lot of other books. It was very intricate. It was very web-like, and I think that sort of necessarily required sometimes you had to go back and maybe pay a little bit more attention. And I personally loved reading this book the first time. I loved it even more reading it the second time. This is the kind of book that has lots of nuance and layers that I didn't get all of those. I didn't get the same things the first time I read it that I did the second time.
I completely agree. I that was my experience too. The first time through, I was keeping track of the characters and the plot and enjoying the setting. And the second time through, I picked up so many nuances. Michelle, I know you read the book twice too. What was your experience?
Well, I feel the same way that you and Bev do about picking up more things the second time through. But I thought one of the most impressive things about the book was the way that you really could follow the characters and keep their stories straight.
And Anne, I wanted to ask you, the tone is as Bev referred to, there's a web, there is complex. The tone reflects that because there's humor, there's pain, wounds, there's laughs, pain, anxiousness, there's eagerness. There's just about the entire gamut of human emotions, and you talked about using laughter to cope with events. I tend to do that as well, using humor to cope, and sometimes my humor, I used, when I had therapy once, I made my therapist laugh while I was crying.
Did you get a discount?
I should have. But the ever-changing tone, what made you decide to do that rather than, say, write a light romance or to write a dark mystery?
Traditionally, I mean, I guess I've written enough books now that I can even use a word like that. You know, typically, I think when people think about books by Anne McMahon, they think about them as funny, you know. And every book I write has some sort of underlying serious content, but it doesn't usually bubble up to the surface as much or for as long periods of time as it does in Backcast. So I think this was really an effort for me to talk about some very, very deep, serious and important content that really affects all of our lives as humans, but in this context, you know, most of us as women, many of us as women, and to try to find a way to successfully do what I do in the telling of that, which is wrap it in this almost veneer of what people allow us to see above the surface, and then periodically to dip down below that. Much like I use the lake as a metaphor in this book, you know, the characters interact with each other differently when they're on the water, and the essays are kind of ways to look beneath what's really happening up above. And I feel, you know, to go back to that question or that discussion about the number of characters, I do think that probably made this book inaccessible for a fair number of readers, just because it is kind of a challenge to keep up with who they all are. And it's easier for the reader and it's easier for the writer to tell stories with a more finite cast. But I really wanted to push myself with this book and see if I could do it.
Well, this is Elizabeth, and I would have to say that that challenge made the book that much more rewarding. And
oh, thank you.
The changes in tone, I wanted to read from a review that Darla Baker put on Amazon, and talks about tone. It was sad, funny, happy, frustrating, intriguing, uplifting, terrifying, and so much more. And then she says something I think is important, and I'm going to ask Bev about this. Recently, I've had the pleasure of connecting with new women in my life, and that's been my experience, too, in the last year. In just a short time, I've come to realize that each and every one of us has a deeply moving story to tell. We have each suffered. We have each known pain. We have also each known love, happiness, and contentment. I'm discovering that being a woman is so different from being a man. Bev, what's your reaction to that in in connection with the novel?
So again, going back to that, really, because this really resonated with me, the statement by Barb about the sculpture and the stories being a latticework of stylized webs. I think that all of us, there's a piece of all of us in this book, sometimes maybe squarely within one of the essays and sometimes spread out across a number of them. And so we go through life and kind of leave the stuff from our childhood. We carry it with us, but we leave it behind in the sense that we don't really think about it that much for a variety of reasons. And so this book and the essays kind of it educated me about different things that maybe I had put aside, and I was like, oh yeah, that informs who I am today. So I understand the point about how you discover your things about yourself in these characters. That it's not to pick up a book and to learn something about yourself when you know we all think we know ourselves really well. That is such a gift. It really is.
I absolutely agree, and I want to ask Jeff about this question, because I was in a gay men's book club, and there were times when the things were absolutely universal, understood everything that was being said, and there were other times like, oh, I didn't get that, because it was unique to a gay man's experience. As a man reading this book about lesbians, was there anything that you found new or you hadn't noticed before?
There were some interesting moments. I actually, I anticipated that I was going to get this question as I was reading the book, so I was thinking ahead.
And okay, like, we were in a book club together.
Like, come on, I spent a lot of time with women. I kind of know some things. I should be okay. I don't think I'm going to be lost in this book or anything, and I certainly wasn't. But there were some moments. There were a couple of conversations between Kate and Sean, who are the characters that had been in a long-distance relationship that were finally getting to spend some actual time together. There were some conversations with them that it would go on for a couple of pages before I knew for sure if they were arguing or not. And then when it would end, and it would be like, ooh, I don't know at the end if that was a fight. I mean, are they mad at each other now, or are they okay? And I liked that a lot. I mean, it was definitely some different perspective, but still very relatable.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And I want to bring in a question from Laura Nastro. She's a regular listener of the show. And she says, I loved the symbolism in this book. It brought such depth and originality to the story. And Anne, this is for you. Can you discuss a little bit about how you structured the story and what led you to write the novel? She's also wondering about the product placement. Was there a commission for you from Astrofly?
Well, you know, I wish there had been, because if so, you know, they're seriously in arrears about paying up.
I love an author who can use arrears.
I thank you. Well, it seemed appropriate with the product in question too. Sometimes I think the back cast is really as much a book about structure as it is about the story. And at the outset, I was very intrigued by the idea of telling a story on a couple of different levels and weaving those together so that they would unify at the end and make sense. And I mean, I hope that worked. I mean, I had 13 authors. I had 13 essays. Barb's sculpture ended up being comprised of 13 fish that collectively make up the constellation Pisces, which corresponds to the map that Quinn uses to locate the best sites to fish in the tournament. So all of those things functioned for me throughout the entire book, and I was constantly having to pay attention to those while I was writing.
And
go ahead.
No, I was going to ask Bev, as a fellow novelist, what she thought of the structure. And do you have any comments on what Anne just said, Bev?
Yeah, so an example about the structure. So I finished reading it, I said, that was a brilliant way to do that. So, for example, and I don't want to give away spoilers, but there's something about there's a reaction that Montana has toward another character, which really, when I first read the book, it kind of put me off, because I thought, well, you know, Montana, she strikes me as such she's a good person. She doesn't seem like a bad person, and she doesn't seem like someone who's got, you know, negative feelings towards someone else. She's very helpful of Quinn. And then when you get to the end and you discover which of the essays is hers, then it was all clear. That's why Montana had the reaction that she did. So it was very well placed. And another example about the structure that I thought was brilliant, I'll give an example from the 10th essay. Really got underneath my skin, and by the time I got to the end of it, I could feel myself holding my breath, because I was so caught up in what the essay was saying. And then you turn the page, and the first line was laugh out loud funny. So the way that you brought the reader to this really deep place of great emotion, and then you let us laugh on the next page. I thought that was a great way to bring us someplace deep, but without letting us crash to the floor, you made us laugh. And I think that is a skill that is I think it was an amazing part of the book.
Thank you so much, Beth. Michelle, you have a comment?
Actually, I have a question for Anne about how she... Anne, how did you approach the writing of the essays and the general story? Did you write all the essays first, or did you write a chapter and write the essay after?
You know, Michelle, thank you so much for asking me that question, because this book took me 2.5 years to write, and I worked on some other projects while I was doing it, and periodically I would get snagged because so much of the content in it is difficult, and a lot of it is also personal. There is a lot of my own truth from my own life experiences sort of salted throughout. I won't tell you which ones, but throughout these essays. Mm-hmm. And when I would kind of get to a place where I really just needed a break, I had suggestions from some close friends of mine who said, well, why don't you just sit down and write all 13 of the essays? Just get them done, you know, and then go ahead and, you know, place them as you write the rest of the narrative. But I couldn't do that. I felt strongly that for the essays to really proceed organically from the people whose stories they told, I needed to write them as they became relevant. Mm-hmm. So I had an outline. I mean, I worked to an outline. I knew exactly which essay was going to follow what chapter from the outset of the book, but I was very specific and deliberate about writing the essays in their places as they occurred, and I think that's probably part of why it took me as long as it did to do this book. And the other piece of that that made it more challenging for me as an author was to try to tell 13 deeply personal stories in 13 different voices. You know, I worked very you all would have a better sense of whether or not this was successful, but I worked very hard to make the voices match the women who were telling the stories. Mm-hmm. and not be my own voice, not be like the omniscient narrator.
And you just answered Nancy Heredia's question. She had wanted to know how you came to weave the individual essays with the main story, and just gave a beautiful answer.
And well, thank you.
I want to interject here that I read your book. I downloaded it and read it in November, and I had in mind while I was reading, should it be on the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club? And I was so happy. I turned the last page, and then I went back, and I matched the essays to the characters, and I went, oh, yes, definitely. And I think I asked you in early January. It's just that kind of book. It's wonderful. And the time and labor you spend on it, it reflects it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go right ahead, Anne.
I was just going to mention anecdotally, and I don't know if any of you picked up on this when you read it. I mean, this might have been so nuanced that nobody got it. But I tried really hard in every chapter to drop a subtle clue about who was going to be telling the next story. You know, so, you know, in each chapter that precedes an essay, there is some little clue or indication that was intended to kind of help the reader know who wrote this one.
I knew there were clues, but I didn't always see them. Jeff, what about you?
I assumed there must be, and I was really looking for them. And I think occasionally I picked up on it, but not always. And I think, actually, we should probably say really quick for people who haven't read the book yet that what we're talking about, the structure, that as the essays go through, they are not attributed to who actually wrote them. And so it's a matter of kind of guessing which character it is. And I thought, really, it was really cool how you couldn't tell most of the time exactly what character it was. That really did show how universal some of these stories were, that even though there was this really specific and obviously very intense experience for these people, like, now you can't really tell which one it was that might have had that experience. And then it was very nice of you to then reveal at the end who they were, so we could go back and think about it again.
Well, you know, there was one real big snafu when Audible first came out with the audiobook edition of the book. They had when the book was narrated, when Christine Williams actually did the narration, and and worked with her own engineers on all the little sound magic stuff they do, and then passed the book on to Audible, because the section at the end of the book that gives the attribution is called an appendix, Audible has a policy that they don't record front or back matter like that. They just don't, because they usually think it's not part of the story. Well, in this case, that appendix is central to the story, and it never occurred to me when they produced the book and put it up there and it started selling that there was no appendix.
Yeah,
so all of the first people who got the book had no clue, apart from what they could figure out. And when I finally realized, I think it was a reader actually who brought it to my attention, and they were Susie Bright at Audible was absolutely mortified, and they were able to go back and get that get that material, which had been recorded and added. But it really does. I mean, I toyed with the idea of not including it, and then I thought, no. I mean, it really wouldn't be. I mean, if I slogged through however many. I've got a copy of it right here. What is it, almost 400 pages of this book, and the author never fessed up, okay, this is the person who wrote this one, and this is the person who wrote. I'd be pretty ticked off.
You know, I've been impressed by your word choice, but I have to say that slogging is not the correct word here. I would like you and Bev to stay on the line. Please don't hang up. We're going to do an announcement and then a song. And I hope you both can hear the song. I picked it carefully for this book.
Okay.
This is Elizabeth. You're listening to the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club. I hope we haven't lost Bev. Bev, are you there?
Yep, I'm still here.
And Anne, what did you think of the song?
I thought it was great. First, I thought it was like Anonymous 4. then I realized the content was a tad more esoteric.
Those were the Artemis Singers, and it was a concert
in
I believe 2010, and I thought, I bet she hasn't even heard Fishing with the Lesbians.
I haven't.
Well, I want to go back to the characters and the essays, and I want to ask each of our panelists, and Anne, you'll be last if you want to answer at all, but what was your and we're not going to match them up, no spoilers, so we're not going to say who wrote what essay, but what was your favorite essay and what was your favorite character? Bev, do you care to go first?
Sure. My favorite character, hands down, was Quinn. And probably because it was the book really, I think, for me it was Quinn's story, Quinn's journey. So Quinn was absolutely my favorite. The essay number 10, Heal Thyself, was the one that touched me the most deeply. And then there were a collection of three others that were one, the essays that I personally identified on some level with, and those were Borrowed Robes, Following Signs, and Bologna Sandwiches.
But that was a very complete answer. And Jeff, what about you?
I have to say my favorite of the essays was the one, and it's hard to talk about it now knowing who it is, but with the woman who was going into therapy and mentioned this woman that she had seen on stage, and the therapist asked, well, how did that make you feel? And then she just immediately went, oh my gosh, am I gay? Is that what the problem has been? It's like, that is a coming out I have never read before, and I really enjoyed that. And how quickly she just accepted it, and it's like, oh, that totally changes everything. Now this all makes sense. I really like that. I have to say, favorite characters, I definitely really enjoyed Quinn. I think Darian was one that really moved me. One of the things I liked about her was that going into this book, I'm so scared to admit this right now, but I was very nervous about reading a book about a writer's retreat, because I can find writers sometimes are interested people to be around. And
that was wonderfully put.
And I really liked that it was a mix of more literary authors and more commercial authors, and so daring and feelings about that, and sort of feeling both inferior but also like, oh, but my books really serve my fans. And so I just found her story really interesting, and of course obviously her backstory as well.
And Michelle?
Well, my favorite character was Viv, because she just told it the way she saw it, and you know, and didn't care what anybody's reaction was, although that was probably a little bit of a defense mechanism. But she was my favorite character. And Bologna Sandwiches was my favorite essay because of the theme of making choices. And, you know, sometimes you're in a situation that's a bad situation, but you make a choice to whether or not to stay with that. Or you can make choices to not repeat a history. And I think both of those things are reflected in that essay.
And I would have to say my favorite essays were An Obscure Object of Desire, which Jeff talked about. I came out at 41, and I wasn't positive who I was until I saw the movie Desert Heart. And that was in the late 80s, and I went, uh-oh. But another one was Borrowed Robes. I thought was just a very moving story. And Heal Thyself. Heal Thyself was extremely moving. My favorite character was Kate. And I liked Kate because she required a good push to do things. And that pretty much is me. She required a push to her girlfriend, Sean, I won't give any spoilers, but she felt she needed pushes. And then she has an opportunity that is posited to her during the book, and she has to think about it. And in my case, Linda Wilson was often the one who was shoving me in the back. But also in the last year, Sandra Moran was, no, you should do this. And sometimes I think people like Kate and me, we need that voice. And I'm not sure if you want to answer this question.
Well, you know, I can. And I actually have a couple of little, because this is what you get on the radio, a couple of little inside tidbits that probably no one else knows. The essay, An Obscure Object of Desire, the one Jeff mentioned and you mentioned, that actually is my coming out story.
Interesting.
Believe it or not. I did have to update it a little bit, and I think in the book I used Cecilia Bartoli because she's younger. Many decades ago, when this was my story, it actually was Kathleen Battle. But at the beginning of the book is dedicated to Ann McMullen Tuller, who was my therapist for 5 years. And I did take a little artistic liberty here and there with that story, but most of it is 100% verbatim. I mean, all of it. Her demeanor, the description of her office, everything. So
I wonder if that's one reason I was drawn to that story.
I don't know.
Huh,
or maybe, you know, maybe you just really long to have an experience with a wisecracking therapist.
Oh, I did. I did, actually.
Well, but that's what that one is. The Bologna Sandwiches essay is the only part of this book that was repurposed from, that was actually an essay, an autobiographical essay I had written many years earlier and submitted to an essay contest that did not win. But that is a true story about my childhood in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So I will share those two things with you. I do agree with Bev that the central narrative of the book is Quinn's story. And I think if I had been a better and more courageous author, I would have realized that and probably written a very different book than Backcast ended up being. But I felt like Quinn was kind of the every man, every woman character who weaves in and out of all of the stories. And insofar as anyone in the book has my voice, it's probably Quinn, you know, the one who's the most clueless and just doesn't get it.
Well, I want to come back. We have an announcement, and related to Quinn and the central narrative, Mercedes Lewis had a question, so I want to give her a question. But first, some announcements. And this is Elizabeth. We're here with the Santa Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club talking about Anne McMahon's Backcast with Anne, Beth Prescott, Michelle Pond, and Jeff Benson. And I wanted to give Mercedes a question. She asked about the premise, how you decided to write about a fish.
You know, I'm so glad she did, because actually my favorite character in the book is Phoebe, the 200-year-old cranky bass, who is kind of an amalgamation of all of the voices we all hear in our heads all the time. You know, and that's really what I wanted to do with her. But I loved, this book is also my love letter to Vermont, which is my favorite place on the planet and where I have spent the best and happiest weeks of my life vacationing up there every summer. And, you know, there are all these stories. There's a rumored kind of Lake Ness monster at Lake Champlain called Champ. And I thought it would be tremendous fun to kind of do a little magical realism spin a la Isabel Allende or Julia Alvarez and create this legendary fish who everyone knows about and people have had sightings of, but no one's ever caught. And I just became mesmerized with that and with ways I could use Phoebe as a narrative device to kind of swim in and out of the stories in this novel.
And I would like to hear from some of our panelists about their reaction to Phoebe. I loved Phoebe. I loved the two guys, too, that provided the boat.
Oh, the Ladd brothers?
Yeah,
they're great.
They are real. I work with those people here in Rome, Missouri.
We all know those guys.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I want to ask about reactions to Phoebe. Bev?
So what I liked about Phoebe is that the reader can, you know, is Phoebe real or is Phoebe not real? And so at the end of the day for me, I think, like what Anne said, she's the voice that's in all of our heads. And so she's really a metaphor for, we're looking for something. We're all looking for something, and it's that big fish. It's that big answer to all the questions that we have. And so I think she was an excellent metaphor for all of the characters in terms of what they had experienced and what they were looking for.
And Michelle?
Well, and I think Phoebe says at one point, and correct me if I'm wrong on that, but she almost tells Quinn, you know, I'm your subconscious, I'm what you're thinking. You know, you're working this out yourself. And I really like that part of her character.
And I love ambiguity. There are some indications that Phoebe might not just be subconscious.
I liked that. You know, like I would try to set these, particularly, I wrote these like the Socratic dialogues between Quinn and this ridiculous, cranky fish. You know, and is she real or is she not real? Is this really happening or not? Well, we all know there's no way it can be real, but then something happens at the end of each of their encounters to make you kind of go, well, wait a minute. You know, Quinn wakes up from what she thinks is a dream and her face is wet.
Exactly. And this is Elizabeth. I laughed at points during the book. Just one line would make me laugh. And an example is when one of the characters says, well, it ain't a working. I could hear Leslie Jordan in Sordid Lies. I heard the voice.
That's right. It ain't a working.
Well, I want to broaden the discussion now from the book to, to do that, I'm going to use as a launching point Velvet Lounger. And several of us know her from the Golden Crown Literary Society. She wrote in her review of her book that it's not just an excellent read, but an important book in a line of notable publications we are seeing from our really good lesbian authors. Lesbian writers who are moving the lesfic genre on, who make us think, challenge us, entertain us. I love all sorts of lesfic, from romance and erotica to fantasy and crime, and we need it all. But I also want us to have literary lesfic, modern lesfic, that will stand up with Woolf, that's Virginia Woolf, Rita Mae Brown, Miller, and Forrest. Lesfic that shows off our great writers, that promotes good writing, that showcases the breadth and depth of our genre, which has moved way beyond the penny dreadfuls of the early days. Backcast is one of those books. And I'd like to hear from our panelists. Do you agree with that assessment, and what do you think about it? Beth, how about you?
I absolutely agree with it, because this book is unlike any other any other book I've read in our genre. And it has many, as I was saying before, it has lots of layers to it. It's the kind of book that you go back and you read again and again. It's like some of those older books that we all go back to. This will be a book that people will read again and again, and every time they read it, they'll get, I guarantee you will get something different and new out of it that you didn't get before. I had also mentioned it's the kind of book that teaches us something about ourselves. It's not just a book about escape and getting away from our troubles. It's a book that confronts us with our troubles, but it does it in a way that has a lot of humor, and it's like you know, she doesn't let us fall. She puts that hand of humor down and catches us. And so I think that's something that, you know, I haven't seen before in our genre, and I think it's a true gift what Anne has given to us.
Thank you so much, Bev. And I want to mention here before we get some other panelists' reactions, Jeannie Ratcliffe wrote in her essay, "I knew these women. I'd met them, socialized with them, loved them, been them. Woven throughout are the project essays, etc. The story is as layered and intricate as a Tibetan sand painting, exhibiting
Whoa.
Such beauty, focus, and care with each character as to make them familiar." And that is so difficult to do. And, Michelle, do you have any responses to what Bev said, to what I just read, to the question?
Well, I definitely think it's a great book, and he's raised the bar, you know, once again. I think what struck me was the diversity in the characters, among the characters, and among the themes that were presented about every major life theme you can think of, I think, is handled, is mentioned in this book.
And, Jeff, I'm going to broaden the question even further to you. I'm hoping to go to Saints and Sinners next year, which is has, I gather, more gay authors than lesbian authors. You have, I'm guessing, read more gay authors than lesbian authors. How does this book stand up in the arc of modern LGBTQ fiction?
Oh, I think, obviously it's every bit as good as the books I've read by gay authors. I was just as involved with it, even though pretty much all of the characters were women. It was still a great book. I was going to say that the way that it's structured is so unique, and if authors were paid by the read, that it was very cleverly done, because something definitely will stand up to being read again, and I definitely am interested in doing that, just because it's going to be a really different experience reading it a second time.
And I read it the first time as an e-book. Then I read it in paper, and now I really want to hear the voices, so I'm going to listen to the audio book. Anne, your reactions after this question?
I am humbled. Thank you all very much. I had expressed to Radar, Elizabeth, when we were talking about the logistics of doing the club, and, you know, whether or not she really wanted me to stay on the phone for the entire hour, because the one thing I really didn't want to do, and I just hope I haven't, because it would be really great to go away and think you all believed everything you just said, that, you know, I didn't want to be here if it would inhibit the discussion in any way. And I hope that my presence has not done that, but thank you all very much. It's very gratifying to me.
Oh, absolutely not. And is your wife Salem there by any chance?
She is in another part of the house, I think, listening to the show. But
okay. I believe, if I remember correctly, that you all met when she reviewed one of your books. Is that correct?
That's true. My very first book, Jericho, which I lovingly refer to as a run-on sentence. yeah, she was at that, and at that time she was writing a fabulous review blog called The Rainbow Reader. And we just got really lucky. I think whatever book she had originally lined up for October of that year, the author pulled the book back for some reason. I think it was going to get published or something. So she was able to slot Jericho in there and actually did the review, and lucky for me, really liked the book. And we ended up corresponding kind of politely over that, which just grew into a really profound friendship, and things went on from there.
Well, we have a few minutes, and I want to ask Anne, you have a book that is a sequel to Jericho coming out. Is that correct?
I do. I am writing a third book that features characters and situations from the first two books, Jericho and Aftermath. And I don't want to scare people off, but Goldenrod is the name of this book, and Goldenrod is going to deal with it. It'll have a lot of the same kind of my hallmark characteristics of surreal, crazy circumstances, but it's also going to have some more serious content, and it has a broad cast of characters, so get ready for it. Sometimes I think I'm like the Robert Altman of lesbian authors.
And that's a good thing, let me tell you.
You know, like Nashville, uh-huh. And you know, where there are like thousands of people sort of moving in and out of all these scenes.
And I would he's another Kansas Cityan.
Oh, you know, it's amazing who hails from the Midwest. I can't even walk around in St. Louis because I'm too busy reading all the stars in the sidewalk.
It's true. Hey, Anne, how would one find you? Website or Facebook? What's the best way?
You look for my star in the east.
In the Pisces constellation.
I do have a website, annemcmahon.com. I do have a Facebook page, which my dear friend Lynn Ames will be quick to tell you is you know, done in cuneiform on stone tablets.
And I think here we do need to have a shout out to Lynn Ames.
I do too.
Now, she says she is the voice of Phoebe. Is this true?
Well, in her own mind. You know, I can kind of see that. I think they both are sort of, you know, have that slight Sideshow Barker thing, you know, going on.
Well, I really, really appreciate you hanging in there for the entire hour, Anne McMahon.
I had a great time. Thank you for reading the book. Thank you all. Thank you all for your thoughtful comments.
And I want to turn to Bev now. Bev, you wrote a book that blew me away. Probably not the best thing to say, since it was about guns. But would you talk a little bit about just a few words about Blowback and what you're working on and how someone could reach you?
So Blowback is a story about a family that inadvertently ends up with a gun in its midst. And what I wanted to do with the story is to try not to take sides politically, but rather just tell a story about the reality of gun violence in the United States. I have a website, bevprescott.com. I'm also on Facebook. I'm actually in a major transition phase right now. I'm working on two things. One, my next book is 2 Degrees. It's a story that takes place in a dystopian future ravaged by climate change, and I will be publishing that under my new publishing company, which will be announced in the fall with the new website.
And congratulations. I did read Blowback. It's a wonderful book.
Yes, and it is an important book.
A very important book, and it just kept me turning the pages throughout. We are running out of time. I want to mention that next month we are going to read Daisy Hernandez's A Cup Under My Bed for Hispanic Heritage Month. And in October we are doing Mark Siegel's And Then I Danced for LGBT History Month. For November, we're going to be doing Sandra Moran's Letters Never Sent. And in December, we will do a twofer, Michael Cunningham's The Hours, but we'll also talk about Virginia Woolf Smith's Dalloway, and that will finish out the year. So hope you'll keep listening. We really appreciate your listening today, and I want to thank all of the panelists, Jeff Vincent, Michelle Pond, Bev Prescott, and, of course, our star in the East, Anne McMahon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I want to remind listeners to stay tuned for This Way Out at 2 o'clock. At 2:30, we have WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. At 3 o'clock, Every Woman. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.